Good morning. This is Mary, and I'll be reading selections from the Decatur Herald and Review from Monday, January 13th, 2025. From the front page of the paper, Time to Replace Equipment? Expert, while age, technology are factors, farmers conserving for time being. By Crystal Reed, Illinois Farmer Today. Many people greet the arrival of a new year as a time to reflect and plan for the future. For farmers, that can also mean taking the opportunity to review their equipment lineup, deciding whether to purchase new machines, evaluating what excess equipment could be sold, and making arrangements for repairs when needed. According to Kevin Brooks, University of Illinois Extension educator in farm business management and marketing, farm equipment sales were strong until 2023. Farmers have spent an incredible amount of money. They are not in need due to profits being down, he said. Farmers are looking at whether they are in a temporary position with crop prices down compared to inputs, he said. Brooks also noted that the average farmer is over 62 years old, and if they are looking to retire around 70, they would not be looking into buying new equipment. There is hesitation to jump in and spend money at this time, he said. Brooks said that when farmers buy equipment, they use depreciation. As farmers age, they need to be able to determine how much longer they will be able to farm, and whether depreciation will need to be recaptured. The rapid change in technology for equipment also plays into whether to buy new or stick with current equipment. Brooks noted that equipment will be highly upgradable as technology continues to advance. Looking at where we are at, technology will change a lot in the next 4 years, he said. Brooks recalled visiting a farmer who had problems with the computer system on his tractor and was down for several days waiting for an implement dealer to send a technician. The anecdote reflects the ongoing worker shortage affecting not only agriculture, but other industries as well, he said. The labor environment affects how farmers get their crops to the elevator, as well as implement dealers having workers to service the farm equipment during the most decisive seasons for farmers. Having technicians to service equipment with advancing technology is especially important because some farmers may be uncomfortable or unable to handle the changes in technology. And the changes keep coming. Last week in Las Vegas, John Deere unveiled a fleet of fully autonomous heavy equipment at the annual tech trade show. Nearby, equipment manager Kubota was displaying AI technology that can detect diseases in crops and spray where pests have been identified. Sustainability was a key theme at this year's CES event, where company leaders highlighted their tech solutions to the climate change and labor issues affecting farmers. Some political factors also could affect the equipment market. One of those is the potential for trade wars with the incoming presidential administration. Brooks also noted that the Russian-Ukraine conflict, competition in corn and soybeans with Brazil and Argentina, and equipment managers like John Deere that have moved a portion of their manufacturing to Mexico. Farmers are taking a step back and conserving their capital for the time being, Brooks said, adding he doesn't foresee any changes in this for the next year or two. Tim Berenga, Vice President of Sales and Purchasing at WorkSaver, Inc., a company that provides equipment for working professionals that own acreage, said he has seen less spending by farmers as well. Nobody has disposable income, he said. As things become more economical, farmers will start to spend again. There is, however, a bright spot because he believes that prices will correct themselves. Right now, farmers are holding everything pretty close and making more timely, needed purchases until prices go up, Baringa said. There were a couple of pictures in here from the demonstration of the tech show in Las Vegas, including a number of people viewing a demonstration of a robot designed to work in agriculture and construction at the Kubota booth, and viewing an autonomous lawnmower at the John Deere booth during that tech show in Las Vegas. Turning to page 2, DeWitt County, lab analysis seeking to identify human remains. Remains found by hikers last month behind campgrounds, by Tony Reed. Clinton, the coroner and police are working to identify a set of skeletal human remains discovered by hikers near a rural campground in DeWitt County. It is understood that some kind of identification was found with the remains, and it is now hoped that DNA analysis will confirm the person's identity. DeWitt County Coroner Randall Rice has not commented on a cause of death. Asked by the Herald and Review Sunday if he had a good idea of who the remains belonged to, Rice said, "We are not for sure just yet. We are doing DNA testing through the Illinois State Police Crime Lab. They have not given me an indication of when they will have a result." The coroner and DeWitt County Sheriff's Office were called in after hikers discovered the remains on Christmas Eve in a wooded area behind the Arrowhead Acres campground. The site offers seasonal and year-round campsites and is located off Weldon Springs Road, just south of Weldon Springs State Park. Asked how unusual it was for such a discovery to be made, Rice said, "I've been associated with the coroner's office for 34 years, and this is the first time this has happened in DeWitt County in my career." Planned Parenthood Illinois CEO steps down after 7 years. The Southern Illinoisan. Planned Parenthood of Illinois announced its president and CEO, Jennifer Welch, has stepped down from her role after over 7 years of service, effective Wednesday, January 8th. PPIL Chief Financial Officer Tanya Tucker will serve as interim CEO as the organization initiates a national search for a new CEO. Among Welch's key roles during her tenure, she led the organization during the first Trump administration, steered PPIL through the COVID-19 pandemic, and actively prepared PPIL for the overturning of Roe v. Wade to welcome patients from all over the country. This welcoming of patients from abortion-banned states included the opening of a Planned Parenthood location in Carbondale exactly 1 year ago, adding to Carbondale's status as a safe haven for patients in the southern states. Welch will also transition from the role of president and CEO of Planned Parenthood Illinois Action, the 501c4 political advocacy arm of PPIL. Welch led PPIA's successful advocacy to pass state legislation to codify protections for patients and providers in Illinois to maintain access to reproductive care in light of the Supreme Court's 2022 overturning of Roe v. Wade with the Dobbs decision. Walgreens tops Wall Street's expectations. Drugstore chain based in Illinois continues its turnaround plan, by Tom Murphy. Deerfield. Walgreens booked a better-than-expected fiscal first quarter and gave Wall Street some positive vibes on the drugstore chain's plan to revive its struggling business. Company shares soared Friday after leaders told analysts they have made progress improving one of the biggest concerns facing the industry, shrinking prescription reimbursement, and said their store closing plan was progressing better than expected. CEO Tim Wentworth told analysts the company has had success modifying contracts with commercial insurers, as well as Medicare and Medicaid plans that pay for prescriptions, including adjusting for high-cost drugs. He also said the company has done better than expected in shifting prescriptions from U.S. stores it is closing to other Walgreens locations that remain open. The company announced in October a plan to close around 1,200 mostly underperforming U.S. locations. Walgreens closed 70 in its fiscal first quarter and plans shutter another 500 this year. The company runs about 8,500 locations in the U.S. and Puerto Rico, as well as a few thousand stores in Europe and Asia. Those stores still face problems. They include a consumer who is buying less due to inflation and persistent theft, which Wentworth referred to as hand-to-hand combat. Overall, though, the company reported a good fiscal first quarter. According to Edward Jones analyst John Boylan. However, we think it is premature to say that Walgreens is on a stable path to growth, he said, noting that prescription reimbursement changes will take time and their impact remains uncertain. In the quarter, Walgreens recorded adjusted earnings per share of 51 cents. That excludes store closing costs, which contributed to an overall loss of $265 million. The company's revenue grew 7.5% to $39.5 billion. Analysts expected earnings of 38 cents per share, according to FactSet. Walgreens also said Friday it was reaffirming a forecast it made in October for fiscal 2025 adjusted earnings per share, ranging between $1.40 and $1.80. Analysts forecast earnings of $1.52 per share. Walgreens began 2024 by cutting the quarterly dividend it pays shareholders nearly in half in order to strengthen its balance sheet and free up cash. The company announced no dividend changes on Friday, but Chief Financial Officer Manaman Majahan told analysts Walgreens was still evaluating the appropriateness and size of our dividend as part of our capital allocation prophecies. Walgreens shares plunged at the start of 2024 after its dividend announcement and never recovered. The stock shed around two-thirds of its value during the year, while the Dow Jones Industrial Average climbed about 13%. Returning to the front page, ex-speaker's testimony, unusual move. Michael Madigan corruption trial enters its 12th week by Ray Long, Chicago Tribune. In the world of Springfield politics, longtime House Speaker Michael Madigan developed a reputation that people in the State House could count on his word. The secretive Southwest Side Democrat didn't necessarily give it freely. He wanted to know every angle of an issue before saying he would embrace an idea or go all in. And he sometimes took his time before he would sign on to a budget deal or agree to back a bill. But governors, lawmakers, and lobbyists, time and time again, came to a consensus during Madigan's 5 decades in the Illinois House, including a national record 36 years as Speaker. Whether you agreed with him or not, his word was good. Now 4 years after resigning his seat in the legislature amid a burgeoning federal corruption investigation, Madigan is banking on his word once again, but this time it's not fellow lawmakers or ward healers he's dealing with. It's a jury of 12 average citizens, and the stakes couldn't be higher. In a move that shocked Illinois political circles, as well as most court watchers and experts, Madigan took the witness stand last week in his own corruption trial, telling the jury repeatedly and emphatically under oath he is innocent of allegations that he betrayed his public office and traded official action for legal work and lucrative contracts for his associates. Testifying on your own behalf in a high-profile case is a rare move that is fraught with risk, and one Madigan, a lawyer and legendary tactician, surely considered from every angle. The decision appeared to catch even prosecutors by surprise, though by the time Madigan faces cross-examination, they will undoubtedly be loaded for bear. As Madigan's direct testimony unfolded over 5 hours, Tuesday and Wednesday, some of his motives for taking the stand became clear. Contrary to how he comes across on some of the wiretapped recordings the jury had heard, the 82-year-old Madigan was relaxed and even charming at times, offering jurors a compelling backstory of a blue-collar Irish Catholic kid who rose to the pinnacle of Illinois power politics through work ethic and moxie. While prosecutors have portrayed Madigan as a ruthless and all-powerful boss, he was able to sell himself as a non-confrontational consensus builder, more interested in building coalitions than scorched-earth politics. It was a lesson Madigan told the jury he had learned early on from a key mentor, legendary Democratic State Representative Zeke Georgie of Rockford. "The most important thing I learned from him was it's really important to strive to know and understand other people," Madigan said. "It's one thing to have your own ideas, but in life, particularly in a legislative body, it's important that you understand everybody comes with their own ideas. Everybody should be given due respect." But even in his direct testimony, the tightrope Madigan was walking became obvious. Trying to explain his own words in some of the secret recordings at the center of the case, while attempting to pawn off many of the more damaging episodes on his co-defendant, Michael McLean, a longtime friend and political consultant. At the same time, Madigan has fully exposed himself to the scrutiny of seasoned prosecutors, as well as opened the door to other previously barred evidence, including a potentially damaging wiretapped call where the speaker and McLean allegedly laugh about some of their political associates making out like bandits. The trial wrapped up for the week Wednesday afternoon after cross-examination by McLean's attorney. Madigan will likely be back on the stand for cross-examination by prosecutors at some point Monday, although the timing is uncertain, because U.S. District Judge John Robert Blakey plans to hold arguments first on what specific topics prosecutors can cover. Madigan and McLean, 77, of downstate Quincy, are charged in a 23-count indictment, alleging that Madigan's vaunted state and political operations were run like a criminal enterprise to amass and increase his power and enrich himself and his associates. In addition to alleging bribery schemes involving ComEd and AT&T Illinois, the indictment accuses Madigan of pressuring developers to hire the speaker's law firm and trying to win business by secretly supporting legislation to transfer state-owned land in Chinatown to the city so developers could build a high-rise. Both Madigan and McLean have denied wrongdoing. The trial, which began with jury selection October 8th, is heading into its 12th week of testimony. The judges told the jury he hopes they will begin their deliberation on the week of January 27th, though Madigan's surprise testimony could push that back even further. Turning to page 4, Life and Entertainment. Entertainment Briefs. Drew Barrymore, Friends Make Breakups Easier. Drew Barrymore's female friendships have made it easier for her to overcome heartbreak. The 49-year-old actress has admitted to having very strong bonds with some of her female friends, and those relationships have helped her to overcome heartbreak in her love life. The Hollywood star said on The Drew Barrymore Show, "I think female friendship has been the thing that has anchored my life the most." Barrymore said, has had some friends for decades, and she trusts them all implicitly at this stage in her life. She shared, most of my friends I've had for 30 and 40 years are going to be 50, so it's like my whole life I've known these people. I trust them. They're very honest with me, and I know that they've seen where I've been and where I'm going. Barrymore suggested that her female friends simply want the best for her. She added, they get you through heartbreak so much easier. Every time I've ever been dumped, my first phone call is my girlfriend's. They make things so much better. Wicked director defends new name for sequel. John M. Chu has insisted Wicked for Good was always the right name for his sequel. The director has opened about his decision to give Wicked Part 2 a different name, which directly references the Broadway musical's penultimate song. Speaking to Variety at the National Board of Review Awards last week, he said, "Who wants a movie called Wicked Part 2? On the script, it always said, for good. And so it was just a point of like, do we really want to call this Part 2? And nobody wants that." Chu, who has also helmed Crazy Rich Asians and In the Heights, insisted no other titles were considered for the follow-up, which is coming to the big screen later this year. He added, I mean, that's the destination. For good, we know, is like, where are we going with this movie? Let's finish this thing. In the song, Elphaba and Glinda, played by Cynthia Erivo and Ariana Grande in the film adaptation, sing about their relationship together and how it's affected their own lives. Turning to page 5, national and world news. Schools plan for possible immigration agent raids, by Carolyn Thompson, Associated Press. Schools across the country are reviewing what to do if immigration agents come knocking as President-elect Donald Trump prepares to take office after campaigning on a pledge to deport millions of people. In several large cities, school systems are speaking up for the rights of immigrant students to attend school, regardless of whether they are in the country legally, and saying they would not assist immigration and customs enforcement agents. In California this week, officials offered guidance to schools on state law that limits local participation in immigration enforcement. I know there is a lot of fear and anxiety about the coming administration's anticipated changes to immigration policy, California Attorney General Bonta said, and I want to make sure students, their parents, and their teachers, and school administrators are prepared. The 54-page California guide outlines state and federal protections for students and procedures for responding to law enforcement requests, ranging from documents to interviews with students. Many communities debated how much and whether schools should cooperate with immigration authorities during Trump's first administration, when school systems, including Chicago, took stands against immigration enforcement. U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement and Customs and Border Protection agents have long abided guidance that deters arresting parents or students at schools and other sensitive locations that provide access to things like medical care and food and shelter. But Trump's re-election and campaign rhetoric on immigration policy sparked discussions over whether those policies will stand. Although the protected area policy remains in effect, it may be modified, superseded, or withdrawn at any time with little notice, the California guidance said. Because of this, and because exceptions to the policy exist, local educational agencies should have plans in place in the event that a law enforcement officer requests information or access to a school site or a student for immigration enforcement purposes. A Trump transition spokesperson did not immediately respond to a request for comment. An estimated 733,000 school-aged children are in the U.S. illegally, according to the Migration Policy Institute. We understand that fear and uncertainty, especially concerning the potential deportation of family members, can significantly affect our students' well-being, their attendance, and their ability to learn. Des Moines Public Schools, where 1 in 4 students are English language learners, said in a statement last week in Iowa, the district affirmed a 2017 resolution limiting interactions with ICE officials to the superintendent. A resolution passed by Chicago Public Schools Board of Education in November said schools would not assist ICE in enforcing immigration law. Agents would not be allowed into school without a criminal warrant, it said. Last month, New York City principals were reminded by the district of policies, including one against collecting information on a student's immigration status. Vermont principal Chris Young said his district, whose students include children of migrant workers and farm workers, has a long-standing policy of requiring outside law enforcement to produce a warrant if they want access to students. Clearly, students who are worried about their parents being deported, or being deported themselves, I think, are high on the list of kids to worry about, said Young, principal at North County Union High School and president-elect of the Vermont Principals Association. Turning to page 6 of the Monday, January 13th edition of the Herald and Review, the sports page with a roundup of the NFL playoffs from the weekends, which included the results in the wild card round as follows. In the AFC, Houston defeated the LA Chargers 32-12. Baltimore defeated Pittsburgh 28-14. Buffalo defeated Denver 31-7. Philadelphia over the Green Bay Packers 22-10. And in the weekend's only exciting game, Washington defeated Tampa Bay 23-20. The final game of the wild card round will be played this evening as Minnesota is playing the LA Rams in Glendale, Arizona. The game is at 7 p.m. tonight on ABC and ESPN. The game was originally scheduled to be played in Los Angeles, but because of the wildfires, the NFL changed locations for the safety of not only the teams, but the people in Los Angeles who are dealing with the fires. The divisional round, as scheduled, will begin next weekend, featuring Houston at number 1 seed Kansas City on Saturday, 6 seed Washington against number 1 seed Detroit, also on Saturday, and on Sunday, number 3 seed Baltimore at number 2 seed Buffalo on Sunday, and then on Sunday afternoon will be the winner of tonight's Minnesota-Los Angeles Rams game versus number 2 Philadelphia. The Chicago Bears interviewed former Carolina and Washington coach Ron Rivera for its head coaching job on Sunday. Rivera's record in 13 years as a coach is 102-103 with 2 ties. The New England Patriots hired Mike Vrabel as their next head coach, announcing the hiring Sunday morning, 1 week after Robert Kraft fired Gerard Mayo after the team's finale victory, to finish 4-13 in his lone season as head coach. We'll take a short break now and return with the second half hour of the Decatur Herald and Review from Monday, January 13th, 2025. Please stay tuned.